Ladies and gentlemen, all the way from Bristol, he's wearing a black t-shirt to make himself appear less chubby than he really is. Please welcome your host, Nikesh Shukla! Hello! I like to imagine that every gig I do is like I'm doing live at the Apollo or Michael McIntyre's
comedy. He does look a bit like Michael McIntyre with the thing
which, you know, with the sort of, it's, I think it's supposed to be an invisible mic, but by very virtue of it being all up in my face, it's very visible. This feels like I'm doing the Comedy Roadshow. So hello, how are you all? Are you all well?
Good.
Are you all here because you're hardcore sci-fi nerds?
No.
James, you've got an issue.
No, it's all right, we're not going to talk about that.
Okay, so welcome to Brightling Sea Library. Are we all well?
Yes.
Is this our first foray out into this year's Essex Book Festival?
No.
No, excellent. That's good to hear. What has everyone else seen?
Joanna Trollope.
Joanna Trollope. Oh, I met Joanna Trollope once and I wish she was my mum. And I said that to her and what was supposed to be a very professional interaction became really awkward right after I said that. Anyway, we're not here to talk about Joanna Trollope. We're here to talk about hard sci-fi.
No, we're not.
Okay, so this is James.
Hi.
He's written about 300 books. Only four of them are on display currently. And so, we're just going to chat for 45 minutes and hopefully not ostracise anyone by getting into the problems towards the end of the third series of Battlestar Galactica. The reboot, obviously. Not the original, because that didn't get as far as the third series, as we all know. So, James.
Hi. Hang on.
James, you've written 4 million books.
I have.
Where do you get all your ideas from?
Nikesh and I have a long-running joke about the question about where you get your ideas from, because it comes up a lot. It gets asked a lot of people. And the answer is that they sort of come from everything. Like, we sort of... I think a lot of writers focus very narrowly on specific events that make them think of something that spurs an idea for a novel, and then that turns into a novel. But the truth is that it comes from absolutely everything. Today on the train on the way here, Nikesh and I were talking about a book that I'm going to start writing next week, which we fleshed out on the train, really, Nikesh and I chatting about it.
I don't see any of the money from this book.
He is not, disappointingly for him, on any sort of commission. I am pleased about this. He's far too good at self-publicity. The idea for that predominantly came from... talking to a couple of my friends who have recently sort of become pregnant or had babies. One of whom, and Nikesh, is expecting a child, which is nice.
Don't tell the internet, because we haven't told
one
of my cousins.
Oh my word, please, nobody tweet that. Please, goodness. God, that was a look. You see, I just stepped over so many bounds of friendship right there.
the thing about the where do you get your ideas from question is, if there was like a box of ideas out there that you could buy from Amazon, like, what would be the point of us doing any of this?
Yeah, because I mean, that's the thing, is that every idea is only as good as essentially what a specific writer makes of it. Right, so the same basic idea, you know, you could say, right, well, here's an idea. The idea is that you're in Brightling Sea Library and there's a folding metal chair and there's a story about a folding metal chair. But Nikesh and I would write completely different stories about that folding metal chair. You know, it would just be it's entirely about how it comes down to you on a personal level.
Yeah, it's there's so many different avenues that you can take it. And, you know, the best writers are the ones, I think, who are... allowing themselves to not only experience life, but also work out the big questions that arise from most interactions.
Yeah, I think that's where things become really interesting. And where, you know, I get astonishingly jealous about ideas. when you read something and somebody's had an amazing idea for a book and you just think, that's just, I cannot conceive how they came up with that. I just can't understand it. And that's, it's a lovely moment as a reader, as I'm sure you all know. Like, it's a wonderful thing to be able to go, actually, I don't, that makes so much sense, and I get it. And of course, that's so obvious now, but how did that person think about that in the first place? That's one of the greatest things about being a reader.
So how did you come up with your idea for the machine, James?
So the machine, which is delightfully displayed here with, as I say, a handsome sailor on the cover.
It's sort of Liam Neeson chic, isn't it?
It is, it is. He's not how I pictured one of the characters in the novel, but because I didn't picture him with a moustache. But there
What I like to think is the guy who's on the front of the testimony and the guy who's on the front of the machine are best mates. And they've gone to space.
Yeah.
And they're just having this sort of weird party on the cover of the Echo.
Yeah. So,
just let that hang there and see what you do with that.
thank you.
You're welcome.
The machine came about, so I was doing a lot of reading about people coming back from war with post-traumatic stress disorder, which seemed a really interesting subject to me because post-trauma is something that tends to be sort of medically diagnosed as a sort of blanket term. It's a bit like depression. People sort of tend to just go, it's this thing. When, of course, there are hundreds and hundreds of different types and forms that such a thing can actually take. And I thought that was a fascinating thing to try and explore. I've always been really, really interested in memories, in the concept of, I've got this thing about photographs and how photographs never actually represent a memory. They represent a moment when people are told to smile. And they're, you know, they're never actually something true that occurred. And I became really interested in the idea that maybe what you remember is different from how something actually happened. And that we, collectively, as people, we try and sort of, we almost try and smooth over cracks in our memories, and we try and remember things the way that they're presented in these photographs. And I thought, well, what's really interesting is that one of the things that happens with post-trauma is that sometimes people can forget the way that things occurred. And it's very easy to sort of start to smooth over those cracks in a really blunt way. And I started thinking about what would happen if somebody forgot more than just the event that caused the post-trauma itself. Mm. And then how somebody else might try to sort of rebuild those memories in that person. And the sort of bigger question, the bigger idea being, are we, as people, are we sort of the sum of our memories? Is it the memories that makes us who we are? Or is it something else, something sort of innately ingrained in us?
But also is the idea of what constitutes an important memory is something that's discussed in the book. Because the setup for the book is the woman of the wife of the person who's going through the post-traumatic stress disorder has discovered a way to sort of boot all these memories her husband has. And a lot of it initially becomes about what she thinks are
his important
memories
rather
than what he thinks his important memories are. So that whole idea is built on this weird fallacy right from the get-go.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
That's the interesting thing about it.
Yeah. So it came about from that. It came about from me then trying to explore what happens to a relationship if a relationship is built around this idea that maybe one person remembered it being different to how the other person remembered it being. Because we can't escape that, I don't think. We can't escape that idea that, you know, if there's two people remembering the same event, you're going to bring your own baggage to that event, essentially.
Or if one person places more importance in an event than another person, say, you know,
absolutely,
the fifth date was really important to the wife, but not as important to the husband, you know, that's...
Absolutely. And and the longer that a relationship goes on, the more time that you spend in a relationship with somebody, the more... I think the easier that those things can become to have that sort of disconnect. So the difference between the things that you think are important. Everyone's going to remember moments. Everyone's going to remember a wedding. Everyone's going to remember a birth. They're going to remember those important key things themselves, but it's the smaller things. It's the how much did this person cook dinner? At a very basic level, it sounds terribly exciting, but how much did this person cook dinner is a really interesting thing to me. And, you know, I'm sure I remember different things differently to the way that my partner remembers them.
Yeah, we'll all walk away from tonight with different memories.
Yep. I'll remember that time that Nikesh came out from behind the curtain.
And I'll just remember the way you were sat, which I'm just...
It's the cushion. Look, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to put the cushion on the floor because the chair's too shallow for it. It's so much better.
I'm just very envious of people who can sit and look relaxed with their legs crossed. I feel really stiff just even entertaining that.
No, I'm really... It's just, 'cause I'm so tall. I'm very... Oh, you probably noticed or not, I'm really tall. And so I've gotten very used to sort of folding my limbs up to try and... attempt to disguise exactly how tall I am.
This is what writers really discuss behind the
this is what we talk about.
Yeah. How tall are you?
That and what we had for lunch.
Could you reach the top shelf?
Yeah, I can reach the top shelf.
Wow, that's so cool. I can't even... Like...
I mean, this library shelves, the shelves aren't terribly tall.
You could get that clock down.
I could get that clock down really, really easily. I could write on those signs at the top.
What would be really funny would be if you just move the time on that just 5 minutes forward when no one else is looking and just see what chaos it causes.
That 5 minutes, yeah, the disruption that 5 minutes causes.
So, you know, you're working on a quartet of books, the Explorer series, but you're also writing sort of more literary sci-fi.
Yes.
How do you feel about the whole... differentiation between literary sci-fi and hard sci-fi? Like, do you think there is a difference between those two books?
Well, so
those two sort of sets of books, right?
Science fiction's interesting. I think that there's a huge argument to be made for a lot of books being science fiction that aren't treated as science fiction. So the idea of science fiction being something that has to involve spaceships and has to be, you know, I don't buy into that one little bit. The best example I can think of is Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale. Which I don't know if anybody's read Handmaid's Tale, but one of my favourite novels, without question, one of the greatest books I think ever written in the English language. It's full of these bigger ideas where all that is really being asked is, if things are different, if things go a certain way, what does that say about our lives? And the best science fiction to me, and I'm sort of, my publishers and this arm of... the publishing, because they're published by two different publishers, essentially. This arm are very loath to call the book science fiction. And I sort of agree with that, because I think you get very, very easily pigeonholed. I think that there is an argument to be made for any book that sort of has this notion of speculation to it, this idea that something can be slightly different being science fiction. So I don't really see a huge distinction between them as it is as well. I mean, these ones here, so the Echo and the Explorer right here, which you can see have spacemen on the cover. This is what defines it being a science fiction book. So they are set in... there is a spaceship in there. One spaceship. The reason that they're science fiction is because of the spaceship. The novel itself is a story that, to my mind, I wanted to write. I had the idea for the book before I had the idea for the spaceship, if that makes sense. It could have been set anywhere where there was an astonishing amount of isolation. And there was a point in time when it was set on a submarine. And if it had been set on a submarine, it probably still would have been called sci-fi because of some of the stuff that happens, but it wouldn't have been directly labelled as such. And that's really interesting to me, the way that, you know, because we do as a sort of the publishing industry does like its labels. It does like putting stuff.
Well, just going back to the Handmaid's Tale example, like, publishers would call that dystopia rather than...
Yes, sci-fi. That would be a dystopia. That would be... And the way that The Handmaid's Tale exists is sort of now it's wrenched out of being described as science fiction, and it's, well, 1984 and The Handmaid's Tale, they are dystopic fiction. They are dystopian fiction. They are not necessarily thought of as sci-fi. But they are both, if you actually look at it, they're both works of science fiction. So it is interesting to me, very interesting to me.
Yeah. So how do you approach both sets of, do you attack them both with the same sort of palette, or
yeah,
do you kind of have rules for each one?
Everything has to be about the story. It has to always, for me, be about the story.
Well, I guess with like the Explorer series, you're telling a story over four books.
Telling a story over four books. Yeah, the four books in the Explorer series are so again, they're science fiction. They're very directly inspired by T.S. Eliot. By a series of poems he did called The Four Quartets, which are beautiful, beautiful poems that really deal with notions of time and death, which sounds terribly cheery, I'm aware. But yeah, they deal with time and death in a really interesting way. They sort of talk about time and the constant movement of time, and the poems really sort of play with notions of what time actually is. And I thought, well, there's very few ways that you can actually talk about that without getting into it being a sort of science fiction idea. A excellent example from this year that does a similar thing to a thing that I really wanted to, well, not a similar thing story-wise, but some of the same themes, is Kate Atkinson's Life After Life. If anyone's read that, that's quite, it's been quite a big book this year. And that's very much a science fiction book, actually, when you break it down. But it's not being sold as such, but it really does play with those same notions of time and death in a way that you can only actually play with by using a device that people will label very quickly.
But on the subject of labels, how do you feel about being pigeonholed? Do you just sort of accept that this is the way of the world and this is how you will find yourself in a bookshop, or would you rather just, you know, say, well, you know, this is contemporary literary fiction. It deserves to sit on the same shelves as Zadie Smith and another book that I can't think of. I was looking around, but all I can see is a crime section. But that kind of comes with its own set of
stereotypes. You see, the crime thing comes with its own set of stereotypes. Personally, if I was in charge of all the world's bookshops and libraries,
okay, let's do this. You're now head chief commissioner.
What's my name?
Paul Cassavetes.
Paul Cassavetes, head chief commissioner of all bookshops, libraries and bookshelves.
Correct. Thank you for coming down to Essex.
It's lovely to meet you. Thank you for having me, Nico. So I'm allowed to pass decrees?
Yep. Decree all you want.
Awesome. So there are suddenly no genres and all books are just filed under fiction.
Wow.
So in an ideal world, that's right. What I think would happen, because I think that ultimately readers are going to find a story that they love and they're going to attach that story. I think that one of the dangers of sort of imprinting genres is that people say, well, actually, that's not something I'd want to read. So my mum is an excellent example. My mum is terrified of the notion of reading anything that's slightly science fiction. Terrified of it. She says, I won't like it.
She is also very proud of James, just for the
record. She's very proud of me, but she's also terrified. Then one day she told me about a book she was reading, and she said, oh, it's a wonderful book. I absolutely loved it. Such a great, great love story. And I said, oh, what is it? And she said, oh, it's called The Time Traveller's Wife. and I said, okay. What, you know, it's about time travel, right? And she said, oh, yeah, but I mean, it's not science fiction. And I said, no. I'm pretty sure that most people would say that time travel was science fiction. But my mum absolutely loved it. Same thing goes with Life After Life. She absolutely loved it. And she doesn't... What my mum sort of needs... Fine, she's never going to go out and she's never going to read a George R. R. Martin novel about dragons. And she's never going to read a novel with massive amounts of spaceships having fights in space. But then... She doesn't necessarily want... She wants to read books where she likes the story and she likes the idea and she likes the themes. She doesn't want to be told, oh, you shouldn't read this because it's science fiction. She actually likes the idea of, oh, that's interesting, I read that and I didn't know that I would have liked that. So in an ideal world, Paul Cassavetes, commissioner of all bookshelves, would have, yeah, no genre breakdowns, which I think it would take a couple of years to adjust to. We'd get some really confused faces. Yeah. But I think most people would probably adjust quite quickly.
Has everyone here heard of the film Napoleon Dynamite by any chance? No, Napoleon Dynamite, this is related.
Okay.
Napoleon Dynamite is a very quirky American independent comedy about a nerd in school just trying to find his way in the world. And about 3 years ago, there was this big challenge. It was called the Napoleon Dynamite Problem, where... So if you imagine Amazon and Love Film and Netflix, they all work on these algorithms to recommend books and films to you. So if you read a book by James Smythe, you will get recommended stuff by Margaret Atwood or Isaac Asimov. And so,
there is a
computer program that looks at what you're reading or watching, and what other people who have also reading and watching the same things you are, and what they've gone on to have a look at and like, and also going through the genre thing. And then a film called Napoleon Dynamite came out, and Napoleon Dynamite was impossible to categorise because it's a film, it's a comedy, it's also set in the 80s, but it's not set in the 80s. It's got rap references, it's got elements of fantasy and in it, and it's got ends on a big dance number as well. So it's a very odd film, and no computer programmer could work out how to mathematically work this film into an algorithm that would, you know, once you watch Napoleon Dynamite, you give it 5 stars on Netflix or on Amazon. What will the recommendations come up be? And you know, there was this $1 million challenge, and you know, that sort of, for me, sort of synthesizes this whole label thing really, really well, because you know, just because I like Napoleon Dynamite and I like Star Trek and I like The Thick of It, how do you then recommend a book or a film to me based on those three very disparate things that I like?
Yeah, and that is a real problem, and it is why pigeonholing exists. It's why labels get applied so quickly. And labels can be a good thing, you know. I understand that there are certain things that happen in people's careers, and like, it's lovely. I got shortlisted for the Arthur C. Clarke Award, and that's a really, really cool thing that would have only happened were it not for, you know, it's essentially because they said, oh, the machine can be classified as science fiction in the same way that The Handmaid's Tale can, so it is eligible for this award. That brings its own set of problems then, because some people might say, well, I won't read that because it can be classified as that. It's a really fascinating discussion, and one that will never, ever end in terms of when... It'll sort of take...
Not until Paul Cassavetes issues his decrees all over the place and labels the world of art genreless. Would that work, though, in practice, do you think?
I have no idea. I think it'd be a fun year. It'd be a fun year to try it, to just see when people picked up something based on... Particularly if we rebranded everything. Take away covers. Take away absolutely everything, and then all you're left with is a description of the story. And then people might go, oh... I like the title of that book. I like the story. I'll read it.
I don't know if you have this problem when you go on Amazon. Do you ever look at if you
people? Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Because often I would just see my own book recommended to me, but that's because I've been vanity searching myself to check my Google rankings, and it will go, well, he's looking for this book quite a lot.
Why hasn't he bought the same two books over and over?
Yeah. Just buy this book. That's what it's telling me. So that then skews the whole thing.
Yeah, it does. It totally skews it. You can break an algorithm really, really easily.
Yeah.
Really easily.
So let's talk a little bit about the novelist's life.
Yes, let's do that.
Because I don't know if anyone saw it, but about a month ago...
We've been getting quite incensed by something.
Yeah, we might go off on one. We might have to stand up and just put our hands on our hips.
If we start shouting, there's some water over there. Just throw it on us.
So, there in The Guardian, there was an article by a guy called Robert McCrum about the death of the novelist life. Novelists are finding it hard to just write novels and have their boozy lunches and all the rest of it.
There was... Look at them sitting in their lovely kitchens in Oxford with their new Argas. They could only afford one Arga this summer. It's a hard life.
So, James and I both have jobs. Yeah, I know, exactly. That non-reaction is exactly the point. If you can't afford to write, just get a job. Right?
Well, so essentially this argument came down to what used to happen is that novelists used to be paid enough money that they could work, that they could, that the job was writing. That used to be the way that it was, apparently, back in the day. Of course, it's not that time anymore, and the publishing industry is suffering, as everybody knows, and books are, you know, it's harder to actually sell books. And people are complaining, apparently, about the fact that they were once paid £100,000 for a book and now might only be paid £50,000. To which I say, honestly, if anybody wanted to pay me £50,000 for a book, I think I would weep for months. I'd get no work done because I'd be crying and holding myself.
That's like 3 years' salary.
It's a ridiculous amount
That's
of
like
money.
That's like 3 years of a good salary.
It's. Do you know what? It's. And so we got, Nikesh and I, when we read this article, were emailing each other, just furious about it. Because there seems to be this strange sense of entitlement that people have got.
Yeah.
That if they're writing, they somehow deserve for that to be... Like, I've written a book. I don't think you understand. I spent a year of my life writing a book. That's not a job. Oh, yeah, exactly. We both have jobs. We both work very hard outside.
I get up at 6 a.m. every morning, which isn't that big a deal. And I write for 2 hours before getting ready and going to my day job.
Yeah.
And then when my wife, who is a teacher, therefore she goes to bed early because kids are hard work, goes to bed at 9, I will then write till midnight, and then I will go to sleep for 6 hours because you only need 4 hours sleep. 2 extra hours is a bonus.
You're like Winston Churchill.
Get up in the morning and I write. Why does... That doesn't qualify for a Guardian article. Why does... I can't afford another argo. Why does that qualify for an article?
And that's I think that people have sort of... I think that people have forgotten, like, the way that Nikesh and I both started writing was that, I mean, fine, we wrote when we were at school or whatever it was that we did. But, like, you know, you've got a job and you wrote in your spare time and you wrote because you loved it and you wrote because you had stories that you wanted to tell and it was a burning thing inside. Like, it was. Like, sounds... But, you know, you wrote around your job, right?
Yeah,
that's the way that you do it.
Sometimes I wrote at my job.
Exactly. I have spent many... I was very lucky to have a job that required me to have Microsoft Word open for a while. And the joy of that is that no one can tell what you're working on. They'll hear this and I'll get sued now.
Sorry, James, spaceships, how does that relate to the housing benefit?
I wasn't working on housing benefits. Why would you say such a thing? I was not doing other work while working on housing benefits.
I panicked. I was trying to do a thing. Horrific.
That would be awful. That would be completely inappropriate. I used to do terrible jobs that meant nothing.
I miss Paul Cassavetes. At least he was a...
Well, he was a go-getter. He wanted to get things done.
Yeah.
But we used to do it because we loved it. We used to do it because that was a drive that we had. And I think that these writers who are complaining about it now have sort of forgotten that maybe they once used to do this because it was something that they loved doing. It's not something that anyone's entitled to do. If you're very, very lucky, and only 1% or something ridiculous of writers actually managed to get...
1%?
Yeah, actually managed to make a living, their full-time living, from writing novels. Everybody else, you write a novel, you cross your fingers, you hope that it'll do well, because from that point it's out of your hands... And you carry on. You get a job and you carry on. And you do exactly what everybody else does, but you understand that if this means that much to you, you'll carry on doing it. You certainly won't go in the newspaper and cry about it.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, much as, you know, people can become baristas if they need to be baristas, but, you know, the thing is, having a job, for me, helps me write, because I'm not just in my own head the whole time. I'm interacting with people. I'm having human interactions with different people every single day, and I get to learn a little bit more about the world
absolutely.
Each time, and I will walk away understanding human behaviour just that little bit more because I've actually talked to someone.
Yeah.
You know, the worst days as a writer, the days where you haven't spoken to anyone all day, and then you go out at night and, you know, you sit down with your friend, and, you know, before they can tell you about that horrible meeting that they had with their boss that went on for 2 hours, you're just like, well, today I went on YouTube and I looked at this video of a cat, and then I read an article on The Guardian, and then I tried to write 50 words and then I couldn't write 50 words, and then I went to the loo and then I did the washing up, and then I went down and sat down and someone had written 3 tweets and I was trying to come up with the best way to write 3 tweets and I couldn't do it. And, you know, it's weird.
True story about my day tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I teach at university, and it's the end of term. They go away for the Easter holidays. This is sad to me in some way, because it means that I no longer have a place that I have to go to in the daytime to interact with other people. So tomorrow, I'm getting up and I've got some work to do on a book, and this is the most terribly needy thing I'm ever going to say in public. My girlfriend's going out for the evening. And, yeah, I know, right? I get sympathy for that, because it means that in my mind I'm going, right, well, you're alone on your own all day writing, and then you're alone on your own in the evening, so you do some more writing. And then earlier on, she texted me on the train, she said, oh, I'm not going out till about 8 o'clock now, so I'll just stay at work late and I'll go out at 8. And I thought, you'll be back later then. I'll be on my own even longer. That's the saddest thing I've ever confessed to in public. But it's true, isn't it? It's genuinely, people don't realise how lonely it can get. Oh, it can get really lonely.
We should write an article in The Guardian. Wow, you're so lonely. My girlfriend went to work at her proper job.
And then she went to that gastropub and had chips.
I had a microphone.
I don't like these voices that we're doing, by the way. I don't know where they've come from. I've never done this voice before.
You'll get home tonight and, well, tomorrow, and your wife will say, how are you?
I don't know.
Nikesh, what's happened to us?
So, yeah, the writing life, it ain't what it used to be.
It is not what it used to be. But do you know what? It's a different thing. And it's still an amazing thing. And it is my favourite thing in the world, is still writing.
I love it.
And it's amazing. Amazing.
Right? I got really excited today. I got a text message from the guy who's designing my book cover.
Nikesh has got a novel coming out in July.
Oh, shameless.
July, called Meat Space, which is wonderful.
So I got a text from him saying, oh, I just got an email saying that the proof for the book has gone off to print. And I was at my day job, and I was like, wow, that's amazing. That feels really nice. That still feels really nice. It's important, I think, to still be excited about things. There's a musician called Jeffrey Lewis who does these sort of wonderfully whimsical songs about being an artist. And one of the lines in one of his songs is called If Life Exists. He goes, now I have a girlfriend and I wish I was more happy. Now I have two girlfriends and I wish I was more happy. Now I have 4 girlfriends and I wish I was more happy. Now I have 16 girlfriends and I wish I was more happy. And that's, I think that's such a brilliant way of sort of describing the process of, you know, once you achieve something, like the goalposts move and the situation changes and you're sort of constantly looking to the next bit of success. And I think it is important to be ambitious and want to strive to do better. But at the same time, it's nice to enjoy all these things.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Joanna Kavanagh and Rupert Thompson. You've won more awards than I will ever win in my life. And you've got an Arga oven, which is amazing.
I'd love an Arga.
I would love an Arga.
My oven is
dreadful. Has anyone here got an Arga?
Joanna
Trollope
has.
Oh, see?
I wish she was my mum.
Yeah. My oven is dreadful. Have I ever told you about my oven?
Is it worse than mine? I can't fit a 12-inch pizza in my oven.
What? My oven, this is honest truth about my oven. My oven has different temperatures depending on where things are in it. You have to rotate a dish in the oven. Let's say you're cooking something for an hour. You've got to turn it about every 5 minutes to try and get any sort of... Otherwise, something will come out half-cooked.
James, this is not a joke. That's a microwave. So... But I feel like we've veered vastly off track of the subject. So, where did you get the idea for the text?
No, let's not do that.
No. That's the other thing about the realities of being a novelist. So I said that's the other thing, I'm in my head, I realised what I was talking about. In this article, they were sort of saying that, oh yeah, everyone just has to be online and go on Twitter and Facebook and promote their own stuff.
And there is a certain amount of, in fairness, there is a certain amount of truth in that publishers do like it if authors are on Twitter or Facebook or somewhere that they can actually talk about their books.
Yeah.
But
you would do that anyway, right? Who puts a book out and goes, well, I'm not going to talk about that.
That's my job done.
Yeah, that would be so uncouth if I sat there going, dear friends, if you phoned up your friends and went, I've got a book out, Facebook's so much easier.
And the reality of it is that there used to be a situation where publishers, because things, you know, publishers publish less books, that they used to do...
Fewer books.
Sorry, goodness me. What did you get in A-level English?
B.
There you go, I got an A. now that because publishers used to publish fewer books,
at least my oven works. Can't fit much in it.
Yeah. They used to send writers on, you know, some book tours. They'd say, all right, you go off and around the country and you'll go and visit and you'll do a lot of talks in shops. And people in general were more interested in books at the time, you know, before we had
Netflix.
Netflix and BBC Three, or not BBC Three, for much longer. But before we had all these channels and everything, yeah, people were more interested in books and they read more. So people used to go and do book tours. And that was a thing. Now publishers won't do that anymore. So to some extent, Twitter is the best way of actually reaching an audience that otherwise might not have heard of your book. Twitter's been very good to me.
Yeah, we became friends through Twitter.
Twitter's been, I met Dan through Twitter, right here, Dan, who organised this event, who really, you know, the opportunities that we've had because of this have been huge. So why wouldn't you want to take part in that?
And also, you know, let's be honest, a small part of me likes the attention.
Really? You like? Hang on.
Yeah.
Now,
newsflash.
Shy Nikesh.
And you know, having the opportunity to sort of shamelessly self-promote, but in a classy way. It's really nice, right?
When's your book out?
July 2014. And all good times. Yeah, so we should get out of it. How do you write? Do you use a pen and paper?
I do not use a pen and a paper.
It takes too long, right?
It takes far too long. My handwriting has become... Apparently my wrists have atrophied. I can't write for more than about 5 minutes on a bit of paper before I actually have to stop and sort of go like that a little bit. I go straight to laptop now.
Yeah.
Straight to laptop. I carry around this laptop with me that's this tiny thing that weighs less than a notebook, probably. And today I was on the tube going across London and I thought, oh, well, I'll do some writing. Laptop out on my lap.
Yeah.
As the title suggests.
I wrote an entire novel on an iPad.
Did you?
Yeah. Meat Space was written on an iPad.
Meat Space, when's that out?
July 2014.
There we go.
Yeah, and you know, there's been all articles and things like that from writers who sort of like to feel every word, like the pen stroke of every word on the page. And I ain't got time for that. I've got a full time job. I need to be able to afford an Argo oven. I've just used whatever I've got to hand. So you know, things like
somebody we know somebody we vaguely know through Twitter posts photos of the pencils when he's finished writing his draft. And they go right down to just sort of the rubber and a tiny bit of the stump of the pencil. And I always think, how are you writing with that? That must be incredibly... Just get a new pencil or get one of those clicky ones. Because then they don't run out and then you don't have a little cramp as you're struggling with this nub of a pencil.
Or use your laptop.
Use your laptop. The thing is, you're going to have to put it on the laptop anyway because publishers will cry if you actually send them in anything handwritten. So you're going to have to type it up anyway. You might as well start there.
Yeah,
that's my logic. Yeah. So I sit. I've gotten very good. You asked how I write in public.
So because we're both people who pretty much we're not tied to. We don't need a particular routine. We'll just write where we find time to write. So you write a lot on the train. When I used to commute from Bristol to London once a week, so I would write on the National Express, which made being on the National Express a little bit more bearable.
Yeah.
You know, writing at your desk during your job on Google Docs is always good. Like, I just feel like there are so many tools available to make the process of writing easier that all those people who say, I've got an idea for a novel, I just haven't written it yet. Why not? You've got all these.
Nikesh is quite outspoken about getting people to write novels.
Yeah, okay, so here's the thing, right? If you describe yourself as an aspiring writer, that makes me really angry because you're not an aspiring writer, you're a writer. If you write, you're a writer. If you're aspiring to anything, you're a writer who aspires to be published in a traditional manner. Which is something separate from being a writer. If you write, you're a writer.
As soon as the very act of writing starts, you're a writer.
Exactly. So if you've ever described yourself as an aspiring writer, from this moment henceforth, line in the sand, you are a writer.
There we go.
Or I'll come get you.
I will.
He will, and you saw him come out from behind that thing.
Yeah.
He can move.
Yeah, and how stealth, you didn't even know I was back there. So you know that I've got ninja.
He's astonishingly quick when he wants to be. He never wants to be, but he
I suppose we should see if anyone has any questions for us idiots.
We have a microphone for questions.
Thanks for saving us, Dan.
Sorry. I want to hear about Time Machine.
Oh, yeah. So can I do a little...
Can you?
Please, because I forgot the name of this earlier on when we were talking about it, and I feel really bad about it. So Nikesh wrote a wonderful... Am I allowed to call it a novella?
Yeah.
Yeah, a wonderful novella called The Time Machine.
Ooh.
Which has been published...
The god of self-promotion is making that microphone stand.
He really is. A wonderful novella called The Time Machine, which I'll let him talk about in a second about what it's about. But it's really, really amazing, and I'll sort of proceed this with everybody should go on and buy The Time Machine. Go online, go onto Amazon, it's through sale through Amazon, and also through Galley Beggars, is it?
Yeah.
And if you go online and buy it, it's absolutely wonderful. And so, Nikesh, how did Time Machine come about?
So, I have my... I wrote a book. Gotcha. Well, one of the, I moved to Bristol in 2011. I'm from London. I grew up in London, and one of the things that I've been trying to do in this new city was try and make it feel like home, and it didn't really feel like home. And one of the things that I realised about home was that, you know, the smell and the sound of it, the home that I was used to, just wasn't there. And around the same time, my mum had passed away the year before, and my sister and I were clearing out room in my dad's freezer, and we found some of her old food that she left in the freezer. And we thought, well, we should eat this. You know, this was my mum's food. So we heated up and we ate it, and the kitchen automatically smelled like home. It was my dad's kitchen, because... You know, the smell was so powerful. When we were eating it, it just tasted like home. And we both realised at the time that neither of us knew how to cook, like my mum. Because none of these recipes that my mum, all the traditional Gujarati food that she used to make, they'd never been written down. So I thought, well, I should learn to cook. And it was disastrous, because I do not know how to cook very well. And so I spent a lot of time with my aunts, on the phone to my aunts, with them talking me through how to make dal and how to make chapatis and how to make this and that, and slowly I learned how to cook like my mum, and now my kitchen's starting to look and sound and feel like and smell like my mum's kitchen, and now Bristol is starting to feel like home for me. And I got obsessed with the idea of that sort of universal feeling of what home is. Like, I grew up with my room above the kitchen, so I grew up with bursts of Bollywood music and the sound of the pressure cooker and the smell of cumin seeds and onions. And so I wrote a novella about learning how to cook with some of my mum's recipes in the book. She died of lung cancer, so I put it out on a small press as an ebook for £1, and all my proceeds from it, which works out to be 25p. If anyone thinks they're ever going to make money from selling ebooks, those are the percentages we're working with. 25p that I would earn from every sale of that book goes to Roy Castle Lung Cancer Foundation. And so since doing that, I've kind of started to get obsessed with how I can take that material to the next level. So now I'm doing a show at the South Bank where we're basically going to get my aunt to cook all the recipes in the book live on stage. We're going to play the music, the radio station that my mum used to listen to, and I'm going to read the novella. So it's going to be like 3D... literature. Is going to smell like her kitchen, it's going to taste like her kitchen, it's going to look like her kitchen, and you're going to hear words as well.
When is that on at the South Bank?
26th of May.
So 26th of May, and if you want to take a trip into London, it's going to be a really, really wonderful thing. Because the book itself is beautiful. It's very, 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 very lovely thing indeed.
Cheers.
Next question.
Yep.
Probably shout, I think. But I'll try that anyway. Thank you. I was interested in what you said about genre and the fact of resetting the library so that things are not put in particular orders and particular genres, because of course through English literature in the past, women's writing became an absolute no-no. Women did not write, women did not know how to write, and women never wrote. Therefore, for centuries, women's writing between Queen Elizabeth right the way up to Jane Austen and Bronte just completely vanished until, I would say, probably the last quarter of a century. And it's now that women's writing is coming to the fore again, and some of those old writers are finally being seen, like Fanny Burney and many, many others before her. But yes, if you had a library where just books were put out, people might read things that they didn't even realise were there, and they might read things by writers that they didn't even know had written something.
I'd throw into that people of colour as well, because...
Yes.
Yep.
Because, you know, people of colour, we struggle to get published, we come with all those same...
So you're coming along with the women's writing thing, is that the new one? We don't want those books.
Yeah, the two days a year that I really, really, really hate the internet are when the long list for the Orange Prize Fiction and the short list for the MOBO Awards, the Musical Black Origin Awards, are announced. I think both of those are amazing things, but I hate the internet because the internet's always like, well, when's there going to be a men's prize for fiction? And when's there going to be Music of White Origin Awards? And I just think, stop being so annoying!
And the thing is, we do, I mean, I think, and we probably know people who are guilty of this, even if it's very unconsciously, who will read books that seem to be predominantly or only written by men.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a huge... It's utterly ridiculous state of affairs that we live in. So, yeah, the Paul Cassavetes thing of stripping back all the genres. So we get rid of names of authors on the sides of books as well. You're not judging anything based on name or gender or race.
Jane Austen, Bronte.
Yeah, exactly. People having to... Exactly. So, but we just got to strip back everything, I think. We just got to go to... Every book has a picture of a book on the cover.
Can I say, there's quite a few of us here that belong to some of the book groups here in Brighton Sea, and I've got to say the library's extremely good about it. And we choose a book, not necessarily something that you would pick off the shelf. So we are actually going through the genres almost to what you're saying, without the... the choice of saying, oh, I don't like those. And I must admit, personally, I have read books I would never have taken off the shelf.
See, and that's the beauty of the book group. That's what books are
amazing.
And I wish publishers came down and listened to book groups when you guys say things like that, because, you know, the worst thing in the world is when you hear publishers talk about, well, if they like this type of book, they will obviously like this type of book. You know, our tastes are so varied.
And I also find that when we meet at the end of the month to go over the book, someone who has liked it listens to someone who doesn't and listens to the reasons. Yeah. And you can have a whole different outlook.
Well, that's the best thing about books has always been the concept of discussion that can come from them. The greatest thing is reading a book and having something to talk to about somebody else with that. Like, you might agree on the book, you might disagree on the book, but actually being able to talk about it in a way that you can't with... I genuinely don't think you can with any other form of media. You can't with film, you can't with... to get inside a book and the depth, and, you know, start to deal with subtext and what did this mean and what was this and how things actually emotionally affect you. Book groups are, like, we're both big fans of them because, and like today I was doing a thing for the next novel, writing, because there's some book groups have been really, really, really wonderful and really, really helped me. So sort of writing to them and actually saying, look, you know, thank you, and here's copies of the next book, and if you want to read it, that'd be wonderful. If you don't want to read it, we totally get it. Book groups are really, really, really great, and they're such a great tool for people to actually, as you say, read outside of maybe what you would conventionally say if you were going into a bookshop, what you'd pick up.
You just wouldn't even look at.
Exactly. So you'll read all these things outside. And have you found stuff that you've absolutely loved that you would never have read?
Yes.
Yes. See, it makes a huge difference.
Yes. Authors that I would have just walked past.
Yeah.
Yes.
or even when we received them, I've thought, oh, I'm never going to read this.
But you do, but then when you open the book, you start,
you can't put it down.
It's the best feeling in the world when you find something that you don't think you would have ever, like something that absolutely blindsides you, totally surprises you, and you fall in love with. It's amazing.
So my biggest bit of writing advice was the whole thing, but the whole aspiring rant.
Yeah.
Do you have a bit of writing advice that you always give out to your students? Because you actually teach.
I do. My two big things are that. Well, actually, there are three, and one of them's contentious. The two easy ones are that if you want to write, you should write every day. Even if you don't think you can do it, you write every day. I still write every day, you still write every day. Even if it's finding time to just sit and type something on your phone, I still write every day. Because it's the only way you can get better. There are two ways you can get better at writing, I really do believe. And I teach this, and it's still the standard thing that I say to all students, regardless of sort of technique and everything else. One is the writing, the more you write, and the other big point is the reading. I'm astonished when you meet people who say, I want to be a writer, and you say, so what do you read? And they go, oh, I don't really. I mean, I used to, but I don't really anymore. And I think, well, how can you do that? How can you? There's a Stephen King quote that sort of goes around a lot that says, if you don't have the time to read, how can you have the time to write? And it's true, you know, if you don't have that, you can't possibly do one without the other, or you can't write unless you're a reader. I really don't believe that. The third thing is, the first thing you write that you finish and you love, I think that you should shelve it for the time being and write something else. Because the second thing that you write and you finish and you love is going to be so much better than the first.
Because the first thing that you write is an endurance test for whether you can finish it.
The first thing is like, can you do this? Can I actually finish a novel? I can finish a novel, but the first novel that you write and you finish isn't going to be as good as the second novel that you write and you finish. So you might as well start with the strongest thing that you can. If you're going to publish it, if you want to try and get it published, writing the second one, that's going to be the best thing.
Thank you to Paul Cassavetes for breaking down the barriers of all books. Thank you to Essex Book Festival. Thank you to James. Thanks to you all for coming. Cheers.
Thanks, guys. Thank you for your time.